From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on January 9th of this year. On that Thursday, Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb joined me on Connections. He told us he wanted real ethics reform in Albany. He had deep concerns about the SAFE Act, and he said that if the legislature didn't have the stomach to address medical marijuana, then Governor Cuomo should not push it through via an executive order. 6 months later, with the budget done and the session finished, we're sitting down once again with Minority Leader Brian Kolb. What's his take on the legislative session? This Wednesday, we'll have an hour with Democratic Majority Leader, Joe Morelli. So Joe Morelli Wednesday, but today, we welcome Minority Leader Brian Kolb back to Connections. Brian, how are you? We cannot hear him now. Brian, if you're hearing me, I've lost you. A little note for our audience. Brian is in Geneva at our WEOS studio, our sister station with Finger Lakes Public Radio, and we're just trying to clear up a connection issue there. So maybe what we can do in the meantime is grab a phone number for him. Or if Brian and the folks down there can hear us, he can certainly call our toll-free number. And while we're waiting to fix that, we can let our listeners know the toll-free number would be the same. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Sometimes little technological bugs. Hopefully this one won't last for more than a minute or two. Again, what we want to talk about this hour with Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb are a number of issues, certainly related to the economy. He's talked often about the economy and the concerns that Republicans have about taxes, spending, etc., what they perceive to be one of the biggest problems in New York State politics. We also want to talk about some of the hot issues that Brian Kolb himself talked about on the last day of the session, from Common Core to the SAFE Act. And then we'll also touch on some of the hot issues hitting today. You might have seen the news, and you just heard Beth Adams reading the news today. The news coming down that New York's Court of Appeals in Albany has ruled in favor of municipalities when it comes to home rule. And so when it comes to fracking, municipalities are apparently going to have a lot of leeway in terms of what's allowed and what is not. That could certainly impact fracking in the future. So let's we got a lot to talk about. Let's see if we've got at least a connection now. Minority Leader Kolb, can you hear me now?
I can.
That's a better connection. And thank you for being patient. We appreciate your time, as always. And so, as I said at the start of the hour, I talked to you 6 months ago on this program, and you talked about the SAFE Act. You said there certainly weren't the votes in the legislature to change the SAFE Act or to do much about it, but you are still concerned about it, and you are still talking to constituents about it. What are you hearing from constituents about the SAFE Act 6 months later?
Well, I don't think it's anything different at all, Evan. It basically, the law-abiding gun owner is saying this is still an overreach by state government, certainly in the too much focus on law-abiding gun owners versus dealing with the real issue, which are mental health issues, people that shouldn't have firearms, and also the fact that from the standpoint of the illegal gun trade, whether it's within the state or across our state borders. And certainly, I would say that the average citizen is saying we're not focusing enough on the criminal, and we're not focusing enough on how to remove firearms from those that have or could be deemed to have mental health issues and could be more of a danger to themselves and to the public at large. And I guess that's the main sticking point that we keep hearing from folks across the region. And again, depending upon where you live, you of course get a little bit different feedback, but certainly in the 131st Assembly District, which is all of Ontario County and the northern half of Seneca, in the overall Finger Lakes region in general, that sentiment is still as strongly felt today as it was 6 months ago or going back to the first day that the law was passed.
When you were on our show in January, I missed the opportunity to ask you a question that would have helped at least clarify some things for listeners who we've talked a lot about the SAFE Act in the last 6 months, and a common question I get from our audience that they want to hear from people in power is, if you were creating laws from nothing today and you have to address firearms, what restrictions would you create, if any, for firearms starting from nothing today?
Well, that's like the proverbial open-ended question that's a little bit difficult to give you a straight answer on, not because I don't want to, because there's so much to consider. And it's one of those things that you don't construct legislation, you know, over a radio show because...
No, I understand that. But do you see any restriction in terms of ownership, actual firearm ownership? Are you in favor of any restrictions? I guess that's a good question.
My restriction would be focused on those people that should not have any firearms whatsoever. And that's when we're dealing with some behavioral issues, drug abuse issues, mental health issues. You know, certainly I think those folks that have had problem with the law in a variety of different sense, that would be sort of the beginning phase, Evan, that I would look at.
Sure.
But certainly if you've got people that are in good law-abiding citizens, that have obeyed the law, have not had any infractions or run-ins with the law that would be provide a threat to the general community, I don't think that we should be restricting them as long as they're following all the proper procedures in terms of purchasing a firearm and also, you know, obviously possessing permits accordingly if it's a concealed carry situation. It's just and we do have a strong regulated environment in New York State, even before we get into the further restrictions that were put in the SAFE Act.
Rob Astorino is the Republican candidate for governor, and he told us he expects the SAFE Act to bring more unregistered conservative voters out than ever before. He thinks there are plenty of people who are sort of disinterested in the process, but he thinks this will engage them and help him. Do you agree with that?
Well, I would agree with it's going to bring more people registering to vote because we've seen it already throughout the area. I don't think the conservative label is really the right label to say that's going to draw that type of voter. I think this is because the people I've talked to, Evan, are Democrats, Republicans, conservatives, blanks, that independents, blanks of those people are not registered to any political party. I've talked to professionals, the everyday working man and woman. So this issue has transcended any political boundaries or labels. And I think, especially in upstate New York, I think it is drawing more people to register to vote. And quite frankly, that's what I tell anybody that is unhappy with whether it's this law or anything else. And to get involved, you have to first register to vote. And regardless of what party or whether you register as a blank, that's one way to get involved. Then you actually have to turn out and vote for the people that you think represent you the best.
My guest for the hour is Republican Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb joining us, and you can join the conversation as well. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. It's toll-free. Or 263-WXXI in Rochester, 263-9994. Now, whether it's Brian Kolb or Mark Cassini, who's running for Congress against Louis Slaughter, or Bill Nojay, a Republican member of the Assembly, we've heard a lot about the concern about mental health issues with firearms, but Leader Kolb, there's nothing that I've heard that's a sort of a concrete proposal in terms of a new way to address the mental health concerns that hasn't been done. And I certainly wouldn't say that this is sort of a smokescreen to the main issue, but I still would like to hear something more concrete. What would you like to see done that isn't being done when it comes to addressing mental health concerns?
Well, first and foremost, you got to have people at the table to design or to provide input, Evan, quite frankly, that are mental health professionals. I am not. I'm a legislator, and when you're talking about crafting legislation, you know, you really rely on a lot of different experts on a particular field or subject matter, depending upon what it is. And I think that's a starting point, that we should have had more public hearings from mental health professionals, from a cross-section of people across the state, and also dealing with the illegal drug trade. And really what I'm saying is we need a heck of a lot more input before you just decide to craft a piece of legislation. And that really was probably one of the biggest criticisms of this bill, was there was not enough public input. There was not enough public hearings. There was not enough information gathered across the state, just like, for instance, the state Senate Republicans had task forces on heroin all across the state, which then led to them crafting specific bills dealing with heroin abuse. The Assembly Republican Conference, had hearings and input across the state on Common Core, and that provided us a forum to get ideas from the public on how to deal with the Common Core, the satisfaction with the rollout of Common Core. So that's really the beginning step, is to have public hearings, get public input from people on both sides of this issue, and that's where you begin. And it's not just crafting, again, a bill in general form without really thinking it through. That's where you make a lot of mistakes.
Now, when it comes to heroin, Common Core, we're going to get to those points coming up here. The next hour on this program, we're going to be looking at the new medical marijuana laws. And you told us in January that you were essentially concerned it would be a Trojan horse on the road to full legalization, and you did not want the governor going around the legislature as the governor was discussing at the time. So let's briefly listen to what you told us about medical marijuana 6 months ago.
Well, based on the proposals that have been introduced in New York State so far, I'm absolutely opposed. I think really what the goal is here for those advocating it in some cases is actually legalization. And I think the discussion about medical marijuana should be held with the governor and the legislature and not by executive decision-making by the governor. And I think that's what we have to talk about more.
Okay, so you didn't want an executive decision, and that's not what ended up happening, that there was legislation passed, perhaps even to the surprise of Governor Cuomo, who said 6 months ago he didn't know if New York State had the legislative stomach for the issue. What's your take on the legislation that passed?
Well, personally, I voted for it, and it's a step. If you really look back 6 months ago, the versions of medical marijuana were really more of a step towards legalization of marijuana, especially in the state assembly. And that was a bill originally authored by Assemblyman Dick Godfrey of New York City. So what happened over this amount of time, both in the Senate and the assembly, there was a lot more discussion and a lot more input about trying to craft a bill that made more sense. So ultimately, and then the governor decided to engage on this issue, which is fine. And certainly you get better legislation when everybody's got an opportunity to look at it. Having said that, this bill, compared to some of the versions that were introduced by Senator Savino in the state Senate and Senator Assemblyman Godfrey in the state assembly, Evan, are completely different. I mean, they're shadows of what was introduced months ago.
Right.
And so having said that, that's why I said, okay, let's begin the conversation with this first step. It's going to take 18 months to really construct how this is going to be regulated. You know, certain aspects of no smoking is going to be allowed at this current time. But I certainly had some concerns. Even though I voted for the bill, I still have concerns that the bill could have been better from the standpoint that I don't think the Commissioner of Health should have final say about what afflictions you can treat medical marijuana with. Certainly the concerns that there are some afflictions that I heard from my constituents, like Tourette's syndrome and lupus, that would not be applicable at the current time. So is it the perfect bill? Absolutely not. And really it's going to take, you know, 18 months for the state to come up with the regulations and how it's going to be implemented and how it's going to be rolled out. And even some of the proponents of the bill have said, you know, the number of facilities that will be able to distribute medical marijuana are insufficient for the population of the state that we have. So I think it clearly is a work in progress, but I felt that supporting the bill would move the process along and get the ball rolling, so to speak, even though it's an imperfect piece of legislation.
Do you, in some regard, feel that you are kind of a watchdog to make sure that this isn't the first step toward full legalization, as you described it 6 months ago?
That's correct. I think there are a lot of legislators that feel that way. And you know, the interesting thing about this issue, if you put this into perspective, if you talk to the average person on the street, and doesn't matter, no political affiliation, doesn't matter, just the average person on the street, and they say, do you think we should have medical marijuana in New York State? And don't give them any specific details of the bill or how it's going to be rolled out. Overwhelmingly, it's going to say, yes, we think we should have, because we want to have compassionate care and intervention for people that are really, really sick and really need some relief from the pain and sickness that they may have. So the average person overwhelmingly will support medical marijuana. Now, when you get into the actual specifics of the legislation, how it's going to work, where it's going to be grown, who's going to distribute it, how it's going to be regulated, you know, the average person doesn't want to know about any of those details unless it affects them directly. And that's where the work of the legislature and the state agencies and the governor have yet to or have to work through all that. And that's why I think overwhelmingly I've heard from people since we passed the bill that they're very happy that conceptually we've passed medical marijuana. But when you ask them, do you know what's in the bill or how it's going to be done? Of course, they say, no, I just know that we've passed it. So now we got to work through those details. And it's hard to explain, except, you know, in a particular case where we have an opportunity to have more than a 30-second soundbite on your show, is that's where we have to try to get the word out to the public at how it's going to work, which we don't really know exactly yet because the regulations haven't been developed.
Yeah, I understand. And certainly on this broadcast, we're going to try next hour to explore it with some members of the medical community, and we'll try to follow up in as much depth as we can, because I agree, we don't want hyperbolics with this issue. It's a complicated one, and I think we should all try to explain it in as much depth as we can. All of that said, Minority Leader Kolb, would you have been, if I could go back 8 to 10 years and told that version of Brian Kolb that you'd be voting for a version of medical marijuana, would you have been surprised?
In general, probably yes, because I'm sort of a specific guy, so I don't tend to say, or I'm going to vote on any topic, yes or no, without having specifics of what this legislation could be. So I would always have couched my remarks with being, well, it depends on what the
sure,
bill does.
Sure, sure. But it is interesting to see that how the public opinion has moved on this. So we'll certainly be following the implementation. Our guest for the hour is Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb, Republican, and he is joining us today to talk about the recent legislative session, the budget that passed in March, and broader state issues. And if you want to jump in, the number to do that is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, toll-free, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Let's get our first caller. It's Bernard in Fairport. Go ahead, Bernard.
Yeah, thank you for the conversation. I guess I'm a little concerned that we're really talking about secondary issues. I mean, legalizing marijuana and focusing on guns, they always sound really good, but I'm much more interested when it comes to the government about the roads in our city, the health care in our state, the educational system in our state. So it seems to me that, you know, let's get to work on the real issues. And, you know, if you want to talk about drugs, that's the good first two minutes of the session. And then in the rest of the session, let's do something that's really important to the people in New York State. Stop wasting our time and having these issues about, you know, who likes what or doesn't like what. I want the roads to work. I want the educational system to work. I want the healthcare system to work. Who wants guns? You know, to me, that's a secondary issue. Whether or not we have gambling, that's a secondary issue. Whether or not we have marijuana, that's actually a medical issue. That's not a government issue. So my opinion is, let's get the priorities on straight. And let's do the job of a government and stop messing around with the politics so much. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bernard. I appreciate that, though. I think I would assume, Mr. Kolb, that you would say that there are plenty of people who do not view, for example, the SAFE Act as a secondary one.
That would be correct, and really depends on, you know, which street you're walking down and which side of the street is different priorities for different people. And certainly for law-abiding gun owners, the SAFE Act is probably at the top of their list. But I can also tell you that your caller is also on the mark from the standpoint of there are many important issues that we should be talking about on a regular basis, whether it's infrastructure, which a lot of the what I'll call the financial end of things are typically taken up in the budget discussions. That's where you're getting into the funding of schools, our colleges, our roads, our bridges, and anything where state money is utilized for services for the residents and businesses of the state of New York. But again, it's always depending upon walking a mile in someone's shoes, and it's always different about what opinions are as what we should be talking about or not talking about.
Well, and in your comments after the session ended, you pointed to Common Core as a continuing problem. And in fact, let me go ahead and you put out a release, and here's a quote from that. You said, New York students will take flawed Common Core tests again next year. While teacher evaluations are an important part of the discussion, tests should be delayed until proper modifications to the program are made. Opting for a Band-Aid approach to fix our educational system is a disservice to the students, parents, teachers, and school districts that are directly impacted. And certainly, Common Core has been a hot issue here, all over the state, all over the country. But what can the legislature really do on this issue regarding Common Core?
Well, basically, as an example, at the end of session, we came up with a reboot when it comes to teachers' evaluations, that there's a different program now in place on how they're going to be evaluated over the next 2 years. Our whole point on the testing was, why are you going to continue the same testing protocol when you haven't really fixed the rollout portion of Common Core? And again, getting to the devil's always in the details and trying to explain this to people, and, you know, in less than 30 seconds, it's almost impossible. But really, the state legislature can always, if you will, intercede, especially if a state agency, such as the state education department, is really doing a lousy job. And we had put forth a suggestion that we put a moratorium for 2 years, and some people want it indefinitely, but there's some states that opted in for Common Core that are now opting out altogether, like the state of Louisiana. So this, the education of our children is so important, and to focus on them, they're the priority, and teachers are part of that system, administrators are part of that system, but the most important thing is, are our kids learning? Is it an anxiety-driven environment by an overabundance of worry about testing? Are we really having a classroom that is open to different learning styles versus, you know, how can we teach you to take a test and get test results and then evaluate our teachers on that? You know, what are we doing to bring in different curriculums that basically that people might be more apt to, whether it's men or women, or young people be more technically applied, whether it's computer-generated subject matter or being the next electrician or plumber or carpenter that our society needs as well. And we just don't have enough public discussion about the whole curriculum for our students, what they're taught, how they're taught. And again, I think Common Core brought this to fruition. And when people were finding out exactly how our kids were being not really taught very well because they didn't really have time to prepare the curriculums, and then we were testing them on materials that they weren't taught on, and then teachers being evaluated because they weren't doing well on this test. And that's where the outcry really came from. And that's why we said, let's put a stop on it temporarily till we get our ducks in a row from the state education department and ultimately through the school systems across the state.
Our caller, Bernard, brought up the question of health care. And again, a lot of the recent discussion on health care has been at the federal level with the Affordable Care Act. But interestingly enough, we have seen some states try to, in their view, rectify a broken health care system with doing something on their own. For example, Vermont, starting in 2017, is headed for what appears to be a single-payer system. And I wonder how much you've either followed that, Mr. Kolb, or if you think New York State is going to have the political will to do anything apart from, you know, sort of following the status quo when it comes to health care.
Well, again, I think from a health care delivery system in our state, quite frankly, overall, I think New York State has one of the better health care systems in the country. Most people you talk to that go to Florida, and they think Florida, you know, you might move to Florida to save money on taxes for sure, but the health care delivery system, even the education delivery system in Florida or other states, is not as good as New York's. Now, what will drive change or what will drive public policy in New York State will really be, do we really have problems to solve, or is this more of, you know, just trimming the edges of the system that seems to be working? But the system is changing, and what's changing is the impact of the Affordable Health Care Act from Washington, otherwise known as Obamacare, and how that is now impacting local decisions in New York State. And I think that's what has to be monitored, because parts of the Affordable Health Care Act at the national level had been delayed. And there's still a lot of uncertainty how it's going to affect individual families and people in terms of its cost and what they would actually have to pay for out of pocket in terms of a deductible versus the monthly premium. So there's still a lot of information that hasn't been sorted out yet on New York's participation with the Affordable Health Care Act. And I guess what I'm saying to you, Evan, it's still an unwritten chapter yet, because there's still so much more that has to be rolled out in the next couple of years that I would anticipate that we're going to have to make some changes. I'm just not sure which ones at this time.
Very few of your colleagues, based on political stripes, are likely to support a single-payer system, but have you heard anybody in Albany discussing changing the statewide model, following what Vermont is doing, trying for a single-payer system in New York?
Not that I can would say that there's a movement of, you can always have a legislator or two talk about that, and they're usually from New York City, but certainly not of any consequence that I've seen.
We're talking to Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb. He's a Republican. On Wednesday, we're going to have Democratic Majority Leader Joe Morelli join us for the hour. So it's our chance after the session to talk to some of the leaders on the state in the state legislature and your access to them as well. We've got some questions that have come in via Twitter, and you can join the conversation on the phone, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. 8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994, to speak to Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb. We're going to take the shortest break in radio, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk about some of where Mr. Kolb is either happy with the recent session or concerned about what the state, in his view, failed to do and what ought to be addressed next. That's coming up next on member-supported public radio. Coming up next hour, all about medical marijuana. Is this a victory for the advocates? New York's medical marijuana laws will be some of the most restrictive in the country. Governor Cuomo pushed for those restrictions. We'll explain why. We'll also explain where and when doctors will be able to prescribe it. All the questions on medical marijuana asked and answered. Next hour on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Cornhill Neighbors Association, announcing the 46th annual Cornhill Arts Festival, Saturday and Sunday, July 12th and 13th, a family-friendly event with live music, international cuisine, and over 400 artists. CornhillArtsFestival.com. And Catholic Family Center, provider of family services from adoption to elder care. Programs work together to address the broadest spectrum of human need. Catholic Family Center, your heart will understand. Details at cfcrochester.org.
And welcome back to Connections on this Monday afternoon. I'm Evan Dawson, glad to be joined by the Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb, talking about what the state did and did not do in the recent session. And speaking of did and did not do, Assembly Minority Leader Kolb, should the Cuomo administration make a decision on hydrofracking by now?
Absolutely. It's been more than 5 years. Governor Cuomo is in his fourth year of being governor, and I think that the decision should have come out from D.C. Whatever the decision is, you know, either we're going to have it, not have it, have it in limited areas, whatever the case may be, so that people can move forward, whether it's the people are against or those are in for it, to have delayed this, and now obviously because it's an election year, I doubt that he's going to do anything at this point in time, at least till November. So we're just waiting for what the D.C. and what this administration says is going to happen or not happen in terms of hydrofracking, or at least large volume.
And again, we're sort of venturing into territory that isn't entirely up to the legislature, but today we've got significant news about fracking. The New York Court of Appeals in Albany upheld the rights of individual towns and municipalities to decide on whether to allow fracking in those municipal limits, a concept called home rule. So you've got Avon, and you've got Dryden and Middlesfield and a few other towns that have already tried to ban fracking within their own limits. Now a court is saying they can do that. And this is considered a victory for the anti-frack crowd. I wonder how much you have followed that case, Mr. Kolb.
Well, in general, I have followed the case. I haven't read the ruling or the opinion on how the interpretation of the law, you know, basically home rule is always a good thing to follow in general. You know, that's the government that's closest to the people. But I can tell you, just as a sidebar, a couple years ago when we passed a power plant siting law, which has been commonly referred to Article 10, there was a lot of pushback because that particular law would supersede any local law in terms of power site generation or auxiliary transmission lines and such. And so it'll be interesting to see if it has any impact on that law that we passed, or whether if New York State passed a law that would allow, you know, again, the interest of the general public greater than the interest of the local municipality. And I think that's always been a kind of a butting heads opinion of those, because in some cases people say, well, you know, not in my backyard, no matter what it is. And I remember when they first talked about the very first cell tower years ago, and people are saying no cell towers. It's the same thing with you know, the wind towers that are landscaped now, that people say, it's okay to have them over here, but not over there. And I think that's the only danger you ever get into is, like, if everybody is to say no, that may not necessarily be in the general public interest when you're dealing with public utilities and potentially national security. Certainly natural gas resources could be a national security issue. And so there's not easy answers on any of these things, and that's why it's sometimes tough to sort through the challenges between local governments and state governments and even the federal government. It's a difficult and complex thing to work through, and in hydrofracking, I don't think it's anything different than we've had to sort through on other issues.
And the Cuomo administration has been pretty historically guarded. The information that comes out is information that they want out. So I don't know that there is an answer to this, but I wonder if behind the scenes there is some sort of an assumption in Albany that at some point, probably post-election, a lot of people, I think, in the journalistic class assume that Governor Cuomo, especially if he has any national ambitions, he's not going to outlaw fracking entirely, but he might try to appease all sides by allowing some sort of limited wells, sort of a pilot program. Is there any discussion behind the scenes that, yeah, that's what's coming at some point, or is it really still very quiet?
Well, it's been fairly quiet, but I've been, I said 4 years ago that I thought the best approach would be a pilot program overseen by the D.C. and New York State. And do it in an area of the state that people, the actual residents, the locals, the local governments, are saying, hey, we want to give us that shot. And some of those areas are in the southern tier along the Pennsylvania border. So, and that's the quickest way to find out, do we have the regulations in place? How are we dealing with the wastewater output when we're done? How is it going to be treated? Where is it going to go? But then there's no threat to, quote-unquote, the other areas of the state that, quote-unquote, today don't want it. So I think a pilot program always should have been part of the mixture, and maybe we will, maybe we won't. The problem you can't get out of the governor is, where does he stand on the issue himself personally? And I think that's what's been lacking in transparency, is how do you feel personally, governor? What do you want to see the state do or not do? And certainly he was very transparent about what his beliefs were on the SAFE Act. So were his beliefs on hydrofracking or any other subject for that matter that he's been sort of trying to be nimble on because it's an election year. And I don't know if he has any national aspirations or not, but hopefully he's making the decisions of what's best for New York State, not what's best for his future in Washington or lack thereof.
Well, you talk often about economic development, and we just saw the deadline for applications for four casino licenses from New York State. One of the proposed sites near Waterloo in the town of Tyre, an area you know well. Are you an advocate for more casino development?
I am not, in general. I opted to support putting it on the ballot for all of our citizens to decide. They've decided and have spoken. I don't look at casinos as being a significant part of economic development. That doesn't mean they're not going to hire people. And certainly you've got competing regions that they're looking for that casino, as you're well aware of, within the different set up gaming regions. But I think economic development is not casino or is not gambling. I think it should be more along the lines of developing business incubators and our agricultural community, anything we can do along the science and research end of things to stimulate technology businesses. I think that's where our money should be invested across the state. They're doing that a little bit, obviously, in the Albany area and in a little bit in the Utica area with nanotechnologies. We've got a little bit of that going on with smart systems out in Canandaigua. The tech farm, agriculturally wise, out in Geneva, just as a couple examples. And I think we should be doing more in the biosciences. Obviously, Buffalo's a good hub for bioscience. So do I think is Rochester. So I think the more we can talk about technology and stimulating entrepreneurs to create businesses here in the technology sector, because long term, Evan, that creates the higher paying jobs and the longer-term success of in sustainability. And, of course, I think in our region, in the greater Rochester region, the thing that kind of gets me is that they're always talking about this Buffalo billion, and I always say right after that, well, where's Rochester's billion? Where's Syracuse's billion? Where's the Southern Tier's billion? Albany's got their billion already, and New York City has got its own economic center with the financial services and tourism. So I think some of the upstate economy could really use some additional jolts in the arm for sustainable economic development, and I really don't think casinos are sustainable economic development.
My guest for the hour, Brian Kolb, Republican Minority Assembly Leader in the New York State Assembly. And after the session ended, about 10 days ago now, you talked about one of the areas that you thought did go well, which was the cutting of the corporate franchise taxes and cutting of real property taxes. Was it enough? Let's talk about those areas, especially in light of the fact that when we hear from pro-business groups, Unshackle Upstate, et cetera, they still say you can't celebrate these without pointing to the fact that, in their view, New York is still last in the country in taxes. Where do you come out on this?
Well, I actually agree with them. I look at any progress that we can make as progress, even though it's not enough progress and not soon enough progress. You know, one of the things I talked about in this session, lost opportunity, same this year, last year, was still reducing the burden on local governments. That was commonly referred to unfunded mandates. Those are the things that Albany says that local governments and school districts have to do, but they don't give any help paying for it. And that really drives up the local taxpayer burden. And again, we've danced around the edges on that topic, but if you talk to Unshackle Upstate, especially in our region, they'll tell you, well, you know, woefully inadequate in dealing with some of the tough issues. But some of the tough issues are because there's a lot of opposition to doing expanded legislation or doing away with certain things, whether it's the scaffolding law. A lot of interest groups are opposed to changing that at all. There's other groups that are opposed to doing anything in terms of potentially pension relief or health care relief with public employees. And again, these are tough subjects because there's people very vocal on both sides of the issue. And that's the problem that you get in terms of whether it's state government or federal government. You got opposing forces all the time, pulling at elbows and saying, hey, you can't do this. This will negatively impact us. And that's where, you know, some things take slower or more time to get through. But when you look at the measurable statistics on where we rank on highest taxes, state and tax, local burden, highest property taxes, where we stand in business growth and employment increase, we're at the bottom of the list. That in and by itself is evidence that we got a long ways to go. And that's, you know, we're not going to go from last to first overnight, but we have to do more things dramatically to change that curve.
We're going to be spending time on this program in the coming weeks on some of those very specific issues you just mentioned, and we're going to kind of do them one by one. We're going to talk about the Wicks Law. We're going to talk about the Scaffold Law. But when you talk about those issues, there are people, particularly people in labor, who say that that's just sort of code for blaming the worker. They feel that you are attacking the worker when all they're trying to do is sort of go to work and uphold their end of it, and they just want their pension honored. They want to make sure workers' rights are protected, and their concern is that when that kind of rhetoric blames the worker. What do you say to that, Mr. Cole?
Well, I don't think anybody's blaming the worker. I think that's the politics of fear-mongering and divisiveness when you're trying to say that because someone says we got a problem, we got to fix it, all of a sudden someone says, well, you're coming after me. And that's not true. I've had conversations with labor on many occasions, and do we always agree on every subject matter? Of course not. But what I've always said is that there are people on both sides that don't want to negotiate, that don't want to compromise, that don't want to make headway on a particular problem. It's either their way or no way. And when you have that mentality, then nothing changes. So, and this is not a blame game. I don't blame anybody. I just basically, let's look at the numbers. Let's look at the statistics. Like people are saying, the insurance companies are at fault for they won't share their costs on what it really costs for liability insurance dealing with the construction industry as it pertains to scaffolding law. I say let's get everybody together and sort it out. Bring labor in, bring the insurance industry in, bring the legal side in. But the mindset in government is, you know, try to maintain status quo when everybody's fighting to keep status quo rather than really trying to sit down and really solve problems. And really, how can we do it better? And what you have to do is everybody at the table has to come in terms of negotiation, say, okay, we can do this better. That means I got to give a little. The person across the table's got to give a little bit. But the minute you start into this blame game and you're trying to hurt the worker, which is not true, on the same token, you know, people saying you're protective of corporate interests by protecting insurance companies, not true. It's just that you have to have reasonable people having reasonable discussions with reasonable outcomes that you can sort of walk away with any negotiation evidence. And anything we do in life, how can we make it win-win for everybody? Now, it doesn't mean win-win, I win everything. It means I get a little bit of what I want, they get a little bit of what they want, and hopefully it's better than what we currently have. And that's the outcome and goal you're always looking to. But when you start demonizing people, calling people names, that just backs people in the corner, and then nothing gets done. But my dad was a member of the Electrical Workers Union. My dad was a union member for a long, long time. I respect the labor force. I have many friends that are in organized labor, and teachers and construction workers, and I look at those people as my neighbors, not labor neighbors. And I think that's the mindset that some try to push out there to try put barriers between people and try to divide people rather than try to bring people together. And that's the problem with our political world in Washington especially, but also here in New York State at times, is people are always trying to pigeonhole and put labels on people that do not move anything forward in terms of better public policy.
Sure. Well, that's a good segue to a question from Marie on Twitter, who wants to know what your take is on right-to-work states and what we saw from Governor Walker in Wisconsin. So let's start with right-to-work. Would you like to see New York become a right-to-work state?
Well, I believe we are a right-to-work state, and that's employment at will. And that basically means that, you know, I was in the private sector for 25 years. If I'm interpreting that question correctly, I want to be clear on that, is that everyone is employed at will. So if someone says, okay, a company or an organization, except if you're dealing with a union contract, which has obviously stipulations of what you can do, what you can't do in terms of whether it's a plant closure or layoffs or that sort of thing that's guided by a labor contract. We have an organization has a right to either hire you or not have you on their employment, and I think you should have that flexibility as an employer, assuming that's what she's talking about in terms of right to work.
Well, what about what we saw with Wisconsin Governor Walker, collective bargaining? Would you favor seeing let me just back up and we'll ask Marie's question. What was your take on what you saw from Governor Walker in Wisconsin and when it came to dealing with collective bargaining and those issues?
Well, my feeling is each state's different because you have different constituents. What's going to work in Wisconsin may not work in New York State or California for that matter. And like I said, collective bargaining works as long as the collective bargaining rules are fair for both sides of those that are organized labor and those that are in management trying to deal with, you know, collective bargaining agreements. I think the right to organize has been well established in New York State. So let's just make sure it works best and that there's a fair, competitive negotiating field for both sides of the issue. And that's where there's some differences of opinion that some people feel that a lot of collective bargaining agreements only favor one side, it's labor. Now, I don't know that's true because I don't collective bargain any agreements myself personally. But my point being is I don't think collective bargaining should not be. I think it should be an option in New York State as long as it's a fair option where everyone can fairly negotiate a contract in the best interest of everyone concerned.
Okay, you talked about the corporate franchise taxes, a big issue 6 months ago when we got really things got going before the budget was passed was the question of whether we would see the corporate franchise tax rate for manufacturing go to zero. And then, interestingly enough, you had a debate about whether that was too much favoritism for certain industries. So when we see the reduction of corporate franchise taxes, especially for individual industries, are you concerned that we are showing favoritism, say, to manufacturing over, hey, let's say I own a small business, but it's not manufacturing. Why should I pay a higher rate than a manufacturer down the street?
Well, one of the things you always look at is, you know, you have to not put this in a vacuum. It's part of the discussion for sure, the points that you're making. But when you're really looking at why do we have a variety of different grant programs and tax incentive programs in the state, it's because we have to embark these tools because we're not competitive with our current tax burden. That's what people forget, is that the reason we're 49th in the state in economic activity is because we have too many taxes, too many high cost utilities, workers' compensation costs, and businesses have now the freedom, the global freedom, to locate any place, whether it's in the United States or internationally. And so what you're dealing with is a competitive marketplace. And New York State does not have a competitive marketplace compared to other states and other countries in this world, which is why, you know, manufacturing used to be the hub of economic activity in upstate New York. And it has taken three hits to the chin over the last 20 to 30 years. And you can just even look at Kodak in our own backyard as an example of that, or Bausch & Lomb, or even Xerox to some extent in terms of major employers. So manufacturing creates the highest added value job in terms of salary and benefits, and auxiliary creates anywhere from 4 to 5 jobs for every one job created in manufacturing. And so manufacturing, I think, is an important industry that should never have been forgotten in this state, and they have, because I worked in that industry for over 25 years, and I saw the benefit of manufacturing facilities, and all, whether it's a small business to a large business, and its employment capability for our state in terms of economic activity. So here we're trying to stimulate manufacturers to stay and manufacturers to come back, because it is such a significant economic driver, which will create higher paying jobs and more people here to obviously raise families, grow their businesses, and that's what's lacking in upstate New York. And you can look at, you get outside the city of Rochester or Monroe County, and you look at these other communities that have already consolidated their school districts, are having a tough time, putting enough kids in the classroom. And these are schools already consolidated. So we've got some real issues that also affect our representation in Washington. We've lost congressional representation because of our population drain. We also had the same thing with population drain in upstate. So now New York City has more of a say in what happens in New York State politics than they really should. So all these things have an impact, but you have to, again, go through all of these, kind of connect the dots for the average person to see why we do or why we advocate for certain public policy. Especially like for manufacturing, we're looking at the bigger picture of how many jobs it could be created if we become a real manufacturing hub again, especially in upstate.
Going down your list of the to-do list that was undone, here's what you write. Quote, "For another year, the Assembly majority used women's rights as a political sideshow. We had the chance to enact historic legislation. However, by blocking separate votes on 9 bills, no new laws were enacted, and women were denied protections from violence and discrimination." Our listeners might remember we had a show earlier this year on the women's agenda, and the question was, do you pass all of them together in one package, or do you vote separately? And the reason, Assembly Minority Leader Kolb, I'm sure you know that the reason that the advocates for the whole package want the whole thing passed separately, or I should say passed together, is because they know that 8 out of the 9 bills will pass, and the one that won't is going to become will be on the women's right to choose, and they're concerned about that. So why wouldn't you vote for all of them in a package? What's your concern?
Well, it's very simple. All nine, there's 10 bills or 9 platforms. 9 out of the 10 will pass, have already passed the Senate. 9 will pass in the State Assembly with Republican and Assembly report, including mine. The one plank which deals with the expansion of abortion. Abortion's already permitted. Roe v. Wade's already been decided. So what they're trying to allow is expand who can practice abortion and what term that abortion can be practiced in. So my point is that there are people that honestly feel we shouldn't do that. So let's have a vote in the Assembly, and then if they have a vote in the Senate and they don't have the votes to pass it, then it doesn't pass right now. It's just like same-sex marriage wouldn't have passed 10 years ago, but it has now passed. You have to wait till you get the vote. So why are you holding hostage the 9 other bills for women's equality that can pass right now, become law, and you wait till the political winds shift and that you have enough votes in the state Senate to pass it? But they're trying to make political statements. They're trying to use this as a political wedge in the 2014 election campaign. I think it's outrageous. I think it's disingenuous. And I think this is also an internal political fight in the State Assembly Women's Caucus, because I know Amy Paulin, Democrat from Westchester County. She's the sponsor of the human trafficking bill. She's got over 96 sponsors, and they're fighting internally because she wants to do these bills individually, but there are women within their caucus that say, no, we're going to hold out to the bitter end. It's either all or nothing, and I think that type of mentality is the wrong mentality. Get the nine, they get passed, fight another day on the abortion expansion, and then when the votes are there, it'll pass. And if the votes aren't there, it's not going to pass. That's why I think that this is really wrong for the Assembly Democrats to have done this.
And 30 seconds, give me one or two of the other prongs of the women's agenda outside abortion that you do think need to pass soon.
Well, honestly, all of them, because you're dealing with human trafficking, you're dealing with domestic violence. There's a whole nature of things that really will impact women on a positive nature in New York State. That's why we need to do that. And I just hopefully that the calmer heads will resolve themselves in the Assembly. I doubt it right now. They're going to probably wait till next year and see what happens in the Senate elections, but we'll have to wait and see.
Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb hanging in there through our sort of blips of technology and taking the hour for us today to recount the session and access for our listeners. Always nice to catch up with you, and I appreciate the time.
Always a pleasure, Evan. Have a good week.
All right, that's Assembly Minority Leader Brian Kolb. On Wednesday, we will have Majority Leader Joe Morelli joining us to get the perspective on the Democrats in the Assembly, your access to the leaders of New York State on Connections. Brief break, come back, and then we're going to spend the hour explaining medical marijuana. We kind of got into it a little bit this hour, but what does the medical community think? When is it actually going to be rolled out? How will it be done? We already have a bunch of questions on Twitter. Your questions on medical marijuana in New York State answered next hour.